accession number 11744, rule 2.
Mr. Wright, rule 2.
Now, technically, their stuff was better than ours. We had many more destroyers than they did. Narvik posed a heavy toll to the Germans as far as their destroyer fleet went. Now, I used to sail from the time I was 9 onwards, and I used to do a bit of sailing off the Crouch and a little bit off the south coast. The North Sea and the Channel have got very, very nasty tide rips. Both of them will cough up very rough seas in a very short time. We had enough trouble invading with air superiority, with a strong navy, with a fair amount of heavy armed battleships. We also had landing ship LSTs, landing ship tanks, and landing craft tanks that were built specifically for the job. When you come to think of it, what did the Germans got? If you nip up and down Holland and into Germany and the Rhine, they've got beautiful big barges with sort of apple bows and duck-like sterns and lovely things, beautiful barges for carting goods about. How are you going to carry troops in them? How are you going to get them across the very choppy, very unpredictable, very tide-ridden seas around England? The Navy wouldn't have had to shoot them at all. They'd have belted through them with destroyers and sunk them on the wash alone. And at that time, don't forget that we were an intensely patriotic crowd. The Air Force was still in being. They hadn't knocked us out. We even had tiger moths and things with naphtha or the equivalent underneath them, waiting to bomb the beaches. There are stories of tubes of petrol being underneath the sea waiting to be ignited. I'd not like to have been a German soldier trying the job. Had they landed, then they'd have won. But I don't think they'd have got beyond the marshes.
And yet, in the Battle of Britain, you thought we were in imminent danger of invasion.
They had an extremely good air force, and they... I think we won because we hung on for another 5 minutes more than they did. We had a fairly predictable leader in Churchill, who had every intention of fighting in Canada if necessary. They had an unpredictable leader who knew that he had destroyed Poland, that he had destroyed Czechoslovakia before that, that he'd gone through Germany like a dose of salt, that he'd made an awful mess of Rotterdam, that he'd spoilt the Belgians, that he'd torn his way through the Maginot Line, that his land army was superb. Therefore, he didn't need a navy, so he didn't maintain it as it should have been maintained. Therefore, he didn't need an air force, he needed a bomber force. He was not a military genius, well, nor was Churchill, but Churchill did listen to people who'd done it once. We were hypnotized like a rabbit and a weasel by Hitler's land forces. We were hypnotized by the fact that he'd done everything that he'd said he'd do. We were very frightened, particularly the closer you lived to the Channel.
But what was morale like at North Weald and Ongar amongst the RAF personnel during the Battle of Britain?
We used to spend our time off duty at home. I was more or less engaged to my wife at that time. She worked in Woolwich Arsenal. We'd nip home, we'd have lunch in the Shakespeare, the nearest pub to the Arsenal. We'd play tennis occasionally. We do all sorts of odd things as normal. We go to the theatre. Didn't think much about that. If we had any spare time off, we would make a beeline for the nearest cinema in Epping, cross the usherette's palm with silver, and go to sleep because we were desperately tired. You know, we had runways to clear, we had ops rooms to run, we had this and that. There was no fear of losing, let's put it that way. We could have been overwhelmed, but we hadn't done so badly so far.
Now, I interrupted you with you going on about the Blitz, the German air raids in 41 against the sitters. And you tell me, I think, about your role in that.
Well, timing is difficult. By the time 41 came, 41-ish, I was fairly experienced in an operations room. I could do most things in it. I could take a telephone message without getting it wrong. In other words, if somebody said, raid 102, 65 squadron will intercept, I'd get it right. I could plot him drunk, asleep or sober, you know. It was then that the Air Ministry realised that if you had officer pilots and sergeant pilots, you could have officer controllers and sergeant controllers. Therefore, they selected a few of us to be deputy controllers of aircraft. You'd have the chief controller on the station, or on that particular watch, on that particular time, who was either a flight lieutenant or a squadron leader. He, in times of stress, had to call on other controllers to look after one squadron or another, or a second flight or something like that. It was cheaper and more convenient to use sergeants on the job. You know, we weren't so expensive, we were fairly capable. Therefore, a few of us were selected to go up to Bentley Priory, Fighter Command Headquarters, if you're going to be fussy, and learn this controlling nonsense. And there was an absolute genius who thought of that particular course. He first of all sighted three places up on Bentley Priory roof and around that he used with telescope and a bearing plate, so that they were his directional finding stations. He stole every possible ice cream cart that he could from Tommy Walls. Now, you're not old enough, but Tommy Walls had a tricycle affair that was chilled in the front, in the box part in the front, and that he carried his snow fruits and his tuppenny wafers about with him. And he used to go round the streets shouting, one of penny snow fruits or tuppenny ice creams or so and so like that. And it was chain driven up onto the back wheel. Now, some particular genius had looked at these things and said, if we put a shield in the front of the bloke who is pedalling, if we put a radio transmitter down into the box of the tricycle, if we put a metronome on top of the box, then the chap who is pedalling can look through slats, rather like those rather ugly windows. He will see only a fixed distance ahead of him. He can't look round and look for the opposition. We can send other tricycles along at a fixed speed of, say, an indicated airspeed of 160, which was roughly bomber speeds, or the equivalent of bomber speeds. We can plot them as they come in on across the lawns. We can have a stupid joker on a tricycle with a transmitter and his earphones on and a microphone. and he can receive instructions from inside Bentley Priory by radio from a controller who's got the plot in front of him, just as he would in an ordinary ops room. He can direct the ice cream cart with its little aircraft compass on the front in the right direction. He can intercept the bombers, and it doesn't cost us anything in the way of petrol. It was a marvellous idea. And that we did, and we learnt a bit about how the hole itself worked, and we were taken down to show them. We learned how the observer core worked and how the searchlight batteries worked, all that sort of stuff. In other words, we got a fairly cheap 4-month instruction in controlling. And either you could do it at the end of that time or you couldn't. Because controlling, believe it or not, is rather like sailing. You can learn to sail in 20 minutes and you spend the rest of your life learning how to do it properly. Controlling, either you've got that sort of stupid mind that can mix up bearings, range, and distances, or you can't. You know, there's nothing at all clever about it. Let's be quite definite about that. And having done that, we all became sergeants. We all went back to our different operations room, and we all were in charge of a watch of airmen, plotters, corporal plotters, people who looked after the floor, and we had our own little desk in front of us with our own microphone and earphones, and we'd look after a convoy patrol while the controller was having tea, or if there was a big flap on, we'd take a squadron, he'd take a squadron, somebody else would come in and take a third one if we had one. It was comfortable direction of reasonable resources, if you like it that way.
This was in 41 that you became a deputy controller.
Round about then. I can't give you exact dates because I've got a rotten memory. No. It was about that time. You can forget about the clever things like whirlwinds, which were super fast aircraft with contra-rotating propellers, you know, a pair of them, twin-engine single-seater fighters. But they got hold of the old-fashioned Blenheim, which was a death trap, and turned that into a magnificent night fighter. Now, you won't know about things like this, but there was a particularly nasty cry among the Air Force of people who chickened out, being known as lack of moral fibre. Now, we had a code and cipher sergeant over in Normandy who had his lack of moral fibre stamp across his papers. Now, he had been an air gunner in Blenheims from Manston. And he went off one morning with 12 of them. He went off later that morning with the 6 that were left. Later on that afternoon, he was one of the 3 that were going off for the next trip, and that's where he said, no, I'm going to live. So he was lack of moral fibre. Frankly, I reckon that he'd earned his pay by going on two trips.
Is that what you felt at the time as well?
Too right I did. Wouldn't you have done?
Yes.
All right, yes. If you like to look at this, we were all in the Volunteer Reserve because we wanted to be. We were in it because we didn't want to go marching round on our flat feet in the infantry. I had one short trip in a tank and I didn't enjoy it. That was on the Rhine crossing. At least in the Air Force, if you were a bomber or if you were a fighter, you slept in comfortable sheets. You were fed regularly. You got a tennis court, you got a bar, you got all sorts of things. You lived comfortably. And because you'd enjoyed being in the Volunteer Reserve, because you got into the service you wanted, you had a bill to pay, didn't you? Which some of us were lucky enough not to pay. Um, Now, these deadbeat old Blenheims, they put a tray of 303 Brownings underneath them, shoved a Mark IV AI, airborne interception set, into them, and they were up-to-date, modern, wonderful night fighters. Now, for some reason, I managed to bum a lift or two in a Blenheim operating that AI set. A Blenheim leaked like a basket. If you went through a cloud, you were wet. If the gunner decided to transverse his turret, he kicked you in the back of the neck because you were sitting on the bottom looking at a thing rather like the butler, what the butler saw. You had a curved cover across two screens. Your two screens were about 9-10 inches across, I suppose, from memory. It's a long time since I've seen one. They each of them carried a Christmas tree, one vertical, one horizontal. I'll tell you why it's a Christmas tree later. If you looked at the bows of a Blenheim or a Havoc or a Bowfighter, you saw a couple of fish hooks either side of the nose. If you looked at the wings of a Blenheim, a Havoc or a Bowfighter, you got fish hooks leaning backwards at 45 degrees on the upper wing and at 45 degrees under the wing. Now, what happened was fairly simple and straightforward. You pooped out a blip of energy from this, let's say, the starboard side of your nose. You then listened on the port side and the starboard side. And anything that was out there came back, echoed through onto that, onto the incoming aerial. That you put onto the cathode ray tube that showed you side to side. You blooped out some energy above your wing, or below your wing, whichever you like, switched it off, switched on your receiver, came back through the fish hooks above and below, and that showed on your above and below tube. You had two cathode ray tubes, you see, one for sideways, one for up and down. Now, if you think about it, if you take your nice little Blenheim up to 10,000 feet and you had to work bloody hard to do it, you got 10,000 feet range because your Christmas tree cut off anything below, because that is where you got a ground return. Are you with me?
Yes.
If you're at 5,000 feet, you had 5,000 feet range. It was as simple as that. And so on as you went down. Now, you took the thing off in the daytime and went off and wandered about a bit and tried to see how much the thing was squinting. Because instead of the thing working properly and looking straight ahead so that you'd know that the target was ahead of you, it used to squint to one side or the other. And you had to realise that you were 10 degrees off to the right, so that your target, which was dead ahead of you, was showing up 10 degrees to your right. And the same with your height business. Well, we played with that for a time. We weren't very lucky because we were using valve sets, as you can imagine, and all sorts of clever things that weren't really working properly. And after you've been airborne for about 3 minutes or 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour, there'd be a ghastly smell of burning amps, ohms and ergs and things, and you'd tell the pilot that your weapon was bent and that was that. In the end, after that we got Havocs, which were Bostons bodged up in the same way as the Blenheims were, and they were more comfortable. They still had the same wretched Mark IV, Mark V AI. The Mark V, the only difference was the Mark V showed the pilot what was happening as well, as if he had enough time to deal with it. But at any rate, it went on. And we potted about, managed to hack some down here and there. It wasn't until we got the Bowfighters that were really good, and I was grounded by then, that life became untenable for the German bombers, really. any 88 had outrun a Blenheim, and it would show a nice pair of heels to a Havoc anyway. I was grounded because they gave us some snap medical once when we landed to see what effect shortwave radiation was having on us. They didn't know. And as they gave us a full medical, I couldn't read the darn sightboard again. So back I went to being a full-time controller instead of a part-time one. Fortunately, I did, because my driver, who was a magnificent bloke, I was controlling him over Paris after Normandy. He came in to see us one afternoon, and I said, all right, I'm on tonight, I'll look after you. And I saw an AK shell hit him and sort of watched the different parts of his mosquito falling down.
What was his name?
Nigel Bunting.
When you attacked a German bomber...
I could never catch one.
But you said that you brought one or two down.
I said one or two were brought down, not by me. I'm a rank card. If I reckoned I was close enough, I'd have given them another course to fly. No, we just couldn't catch them. We chased one round and round Norfolk for about 20 minutes, and I'll swear the Observer Corps were making us chase our own tail round. We had one magnificent period of full moon where this one had better not be kept on. Half my watch were being posted overseas to North Africa. Been down to the King's Head to wish him goodbye and sort of christen them again, you know. And I actually carried one 14-stone bloke back to the billet. I must have been drunk. And when I stopped the bed from rotating, I just got comfortably off to sleep when a chap came up in a motorcycle and sidecar. The deputy controller on duty had developed appendicitis, being whipped off, and I had to take his place. And it was what was known as a fighter night, where we had hurricanes in the air. And, I suppose there are about 7 or 8 of them floating about over Essex. Sheer pandemonium. I think they managed to get some bombers down with the fighter night, but you can imagine how difficult it was, even in broad moonlight, trying to get day-fighting hurricanes that you can't see, don't forget, through the propeller anyway, back onto North Weald ground. I think I stayed on duty for about 30 hours, that, you know, because I was due to be relieved by the bloke in hospital and so on. Now, ultimately, because I knew something about night fighting and the controlling of night fighters, I was headhunted and sent up to Debden. No real reason for it, but the controller knew me. He knew what I could do, a chap called Farnes. And I got lumbered with a job up there. Very pleasant, thoroughly enjoyed it. Got married by that time as well.
This was still as deputy controller?
Yes. It was up there that they had a brilliant idea of flying Havocs, complete with a Lee light, like the thing they used in submarine warfare on the front, putting little bands of light alongside the Havoc and flying 249 Squadron Black Hurricanes as night fighters alongside it. So you found your German, you illuminated him with your Lee light and shot him down with your... It never worked. I think we shot down a Wellington. I'm not quite sure. But it was about in that street. Now, at Debden, ultimately, I was put on to another course at East Hill up near Luton, where I was learning to be a radar controller. Now, at that time, we began to put radar the ground control interception mobs began to come into being. There was one down near Portsmouth that was really good. The next one was at Waldring Field, and then we began to build proper stations. Now, East Hill taught controllers to become radar controllers. It was quite a pleasant business. You lived in private billets. You spent 16 hours a day learning something about radar sets, particularly ground control interception ones. You learnt to read angles dead accurately without any help whatsoever. I can't do it now, but at one time I could give you a course exactly by sheer guesswork. You know, that's 240, and that's that. A squadron leader Bickerstaff ran it, and he was an ex-private schoolmaster who used to carry his shotgun on duty with him. And as soon as he saw a rabbit over there, a window in the way or not, he upped and pooped off at it smartly in the middle of his lecture, which was rather fascinating. I managed to crawl through that course somehow. I don't know how. But I was then posted to Trimley Heath, which was just outside Felixstowe. And there you had, again, a senior controller, plus a whole lot of odd bodies. You might be a flying officer, you might be a sergeant. And you had a little tiny cell about the size of a dining room with a television set like that thing in front of it. And that was the place that you controlled from. Around it was a little tiny map of the neighbourhood, gridded again like the old-fashioned ops room map. Quite pointlessly, but from the centre was the usual strip of light like a second hand on a watch, doing circuit for about four or five times a minute. As that went past a target, so you got a little blip of light, and that was your target. Your night fighters or your day fighters carried a thing called a cockerel, which produced on that a coded strip. You'd say, "Canary, please," and you'd switch this damn thing on, and you could separate Hotspur 3-4 from Hotspur 2-6 or whatever you wanted, you see, or from the German bombers. Does that make sense to you?
What was Hotspur 3-4?
Well, let's call him. It's just the call sign of any odd squadron. It doesn't matter. But don't forget that your night fighters flew individually, so that your CO would be Hotspur 1-4, and so on. You worked your way through. And am I making sense about this cockerel nonsense?
Yeah.
Good. Now, you carried on. You controlled. Throughout the night, you had at least two aircraft up, and you did practice interceptions, both for your AI operator and for your crew. Nothing terribly clever about it, it's just straightforward work. They'd swap places practically after each run, you know, so that one chap would be target, the next chap would be the fighter, and so on.